When you play a game of Jenga right at the beginning, you can pull a block from anywhere and the tower barely even wobbles.
Right, it's totally solid.
Exactly. It's got all this redundancy built in. But, late in the game, the tower is just full of gaps.
It's mostly air by that point.
Yeah, and you barely tap a block at the bottom and the entire top sways dangerously. I mean, we have all felt that tension lately, right? Just
Yeah.
waiting for the whole thing to come down.
It's a very real feeling. It is the physical sensation of systemic fragility. When you remove those foundational supports, whether that is economic surplus or supply chain redundancy or just institutional trust, the structure loses its ability to absorb even a minor shock.
Well, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today we are pulling from the Great Awakening Report's briefing, and this is for May 22nd, 2026. This is your Truth Seeker Weekly Briefing, focusing on the mainstream media featured news for the week.
Glad to be here.
And look, if you have been feeling this immense, almost ambient stress lately, whether you're looking at the global stage or navigating U.S. politics or just dealing with the daily grinding challenge of operating in an overwhelming world, you are not crazy. You are just feeling that tower sway.
Absolutely. And our mission today is to step back from that daily noise and observe the structure itself. We are looking at what analysts are calling the Great Convergence.
The Great Convergence.
Right, because this is not an isolated political crisis or like a singular economic dip. It is the simultaneous breakdown of geopolitical, economic, and infrastructure systems that historically operate independently.
But our goal here isn't to just, dwell on the collapse.
No, not at all. It is to recognize that this friction actually signals a massive rise in human sovereignty. We are moving past just passively consuming headlines, and we are learning to trace the signals, pull the threads, and understand the deep mechanics of what is actually happening out there.
So let's start pulling those threads right at the absolute base of the tower. I want to look at the literal fuel of the global system, which is the extreme fragility of global energy and geography.
The physical choke points.
Exactly. The map of conflict right now, it's not just a single hotspot anymore. It is this widening, continuous arc. We have the entrenched NATO-Russia attrition in Eastern Europe, which is fundamentally reshaping global alliances.
Yeah, that's a massive shift.
And then in the Western Hemisphere, we're seeing intense pressures across Mexico, Cuba, and Colombia. You've got cartel expansion and massive migration flows right through the U.S. border. But the absolute critical vulnerability, the true choke point, remains the Middle East.
We really have to zoom in on the Strait of Hormuz to understand this part of it. Professor Jiang Suishin released a brilliant analysis recently on the unraveling ceasefire in the region.
Oh, I read that. It was fascinating.
Right. And he pointed to a specific metric that is largely being ignored by the mainstream. There are currently 1,600 ships trapped near the strait.
Wow. Wait, I want to pause on that number because the scale is just, it's hard to conceptualize. 1,600 cargo ships.
It's massive.
That is millions of tons of goods, fuel, and agricultural products essentially just parked on the ocean.
So let's break down the actual mechanism of why that is catastrophic. The global economy over the last 40 years has optimized for absolute financial efficiency.
Yeah.
We shifted to a just-in-time delivery model.
Right. Nobody wants to pay for storage anymore.
Exactly. Corporations realized it was just too expensive to hold large inventories in warehouses, so they basically turned the ocean shipping lanes into their floating warehouses.
That makes sense.
Goods arrive exactly the day they are needed on the assembly line or the grocery shelf, and it is incredibly profitable,
It
but
removes all the redundancy.
zero margin for error. When you trap 1,600 ships at a major choke point, you don't just delay an Amazon package. The factories run out of parts within days, the fuel depots run dry, the entire, like, highly strung global supply chain just seizes up.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because I always think of it like a race car versus an off-road vehicle.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. Like our global supply chain is this finely tuned race car. It is incredibly fast on a perfectly smooth track. But you put one plot hole in front of it, and the suspension shatters. It is completely incapable of handling rough terrain.
That is exactly what's happening.
But wait, I have to challenge this a bit. Because historically, haven't we navigated massive global supply disruptions before? I mean, during the Second World War, the globe was essentially on fire across multiple theaters.
Sure.
Even during the 2008 financial crisis, the entire banking system froze globally. So why is this specific convergence fundamentally harder for our current governments to manage?
Well, it comes down to the nature of the machinery. During World War II, governments commanded massive dormant industrial bases that they could instantly mobilize and repurpose. They created redundancy through brute force and domestic manufacturing.
Okay, so they built their way out of it.
Right. And in 2008, the crisis was acute, but it was concentrated entirely within the financial sector, which allowed central banks to just flood that specific zone with liquidity.
They could just print money to fix it.
Exactly. But today, the crisis is decentralized and it's physical. We have stripped away our domestic industrial bases in favor of these complex international supply chains.
So the race car is broken.
Yes. Governments are structurally designed to manage acute, isolated shocks. They do not have the bureaucratic machinery or, frankly, the physical levers to manage chronic overlapping physical attrition across every single hemisphere simultaneously.
So when that bureaucratic machinery fails to clear a shipping lane in the Middle East, the pressure immediately cascades right down to the listener's daily life.
Instantly.
Let's walk through the mechanics of that domino effect, particularly regarding our food and water supply. Because I was looking at the CME Group data in our source material, and they're reporting that their supply chain pressure indexes are hitting levels we haven't seen since 2022.
Yeah, those numbers are startling.
But what does that index actually capture?
So the CME index aggregates a matrix of friction points. We're talking freight costs, port delays, insurance premiums, and inventory backlogs. When that index spikes, it means the friction has become highly expensive.
Okay, so it's a measure of cost stress.
Exactly. Shipping companies are facing chronic maritime labor shortages. And because of the regional instability we just discussed, the insurance underwriters are viewing these corridors as active conflict zones.
Wow, so the insurance companies are dictating the shipping routes.
Pretty much. The premiums to send a cargo ship through these areas are just skyrocketing right now.
And that added cost doesn't just evaporate. It gets baked into the cost of the goods on the shelf, which is incredibly dangerous when we look at the agricultural sector, because the margins for farmers right now are impossibly thin.
Right. And you have to remember, agriculture is essentially a mechanism for converting energy into food.
Oh, I like that. Converting energy into food.
Yeah. I mean, think about a loaf of bread at the store. It isn't just wheat. It is the diesel fuel used by the tractors to harvest it. It is the natural gas required to manufacture the synthetic fertilizers. It's the marine fuel burned by the cargo ships to transport it.
It's all connected to energy.
Exactly. So when a geopolitical event traps 1,600 ships, the global supply of fertilizer components shrinks, the cost of diesel spikes, and the farmer has to pay exponentially more just to yield the exact same crop.
And then you combine that with extreme climate volatility, and the food supply becomes wildly insecure.
It's a perfect storm.
We also have to fold water scarcity into this equation, because it is quietly emerging as the foundational tension point of the decade. We tend to view water as this localized environmental issue, but the sources point to a direct escalating conflict between agricultural demand and urban water needs.
It is a zero-sum game when resources tighten. Moving and treating water requires immense amounts of electricity.
Right.
So when energy is expensive or the grid is strained, things like desalination and large-scale water transport become completely financially unviable. Cities demand water to function, but agriculture demands it to keep the population fed.
So they're competing for the same shrinking resource.
Exactly. This forces regional governments into impossible choices, turning water from just a basic utility into a profound geopolitical weapon and a source of deep domestic tension.
But this physical reality introduces a massive paradox. Because if the supply chains are this strained, and if the agricultural margins are collapsing, and energy corridors are under constant threat, why do the official institutional economic numbers paint such a rosy picture?
The narrative gap.
Right. We see headlines constantly declaring that inflation is moderating and the economy is super robust.
Well, you are identifying the widening gap between institutional messaging and lived reality. If you look purely at official economic narratives, the system appears totally stable. But if you look at household budgets, the listener knows the truth.
The grocery bill doesn't lie.
No, it doesn't. Food costs remain permanently elevated. Insurance premiums for homes, cars, health, they are tearing through budgets. Housing is effectively unaffordable for a massive demographic. And heavy debt servicing is quietly crushing the middle class.
And what's wild is that beneath those loud, positive headlines, the institutions themselves seem to know the truth. Like the United Nations recently, and very quietly, cut their global growth forecasts.
Signaling we are entering a dangerous new phase, yes.
Which brings up a concept from our research that I found absolutely fascinating. Here's where it gets really interesting. Confidence dependency.
It is arguably the most vital concept for understanding modern finance. Our global economic system is no longer tethered to hard assets or pure industrial production.
Right, it's not based on gold anymore.
No, it is tethered to perception. Fiat currency and fractional reserve banking rely entirely on the belief that the system works. If the public believes their money is safe, they leave it in the bank. They keep spending, taking out mortgages, and paying their debts.
But the moment the public loses confidence?
The system contracts violently. A bank run isn't caused by a bank actually losing the money. It is caused by the public believing the bank lost the money.
Wow, yeah.
The underlying physical assets can remain completely unchanged, but if the narrative cracks, the psychological panic creates a physical collapse.
So I have to ask a blunt question about this. Mm-hmm. Are central banks and governments actively engaged in malicious deception? Like, are they simply lying to the public to protect their own interests? Or is the global economy now so incredibly fragile that maintaining this psychological stability narrative is literally the only thing holding the framework together?
That is the line between intent and mechanics. It is highly likely an issue of structural desperation.
Desperation.
Yeah. The central banks are fully aware that the system lacks resilience. They understand that if they issue a stark, honest warning about the fragility of the banking sector or, say, the permanence of inflation, capital flight would occur instant.
Everyone would just pull their money out.
Right. Corporations would freeze hiring, banks would stop lending, and the exact crisis they are trying to prevent would immediately materialize. In modern finance, positive framing isn't just PR. It is a necessary tool of economic infrastructure. It is load-bearing psychology.
Load-bearing psychology. That is a brilliant way to phrase it. But, you know, psychology has a hard limit.
It does.
You can convince a market not to panic, but you cannot convince a power plant to generate electricity through pure belief. That narrative framework hits a brick wall when it meets the laws of physics.
And physics is currently winning. While the economic system attempts to manage perception, our actual physical infrastructure is running dangerously hot. We are seeing aging national power grids being pushed far beyond their designed capacity.
Because we have a massive convergence of physical demands right now. You have federal mandates pushing for rapid, widespread electrification of vehicles and heating. You have extreme heat events forcing air conditioning systems to run continuously.
And then layer on top of all of that, the insatiable power demand from massive data centers.
Oh, right. The AI boom.
Exactly. The cloud computing and artificial intelligence requirements are staggering, all of which stretches the physical limits of the grid. But it also introduces an entirely new vector of vulnerability. As these systems become hyper-connected and digitized to manage the load, they become targets.
Cyber targets.
Yes. Yeah. We are tracking a serious escalation in state and non-state actors actively probing our water treatment facilities, our transport networks, and our energy sectors.
Yeah, the sources reference a specific analytical framework for this called man versus disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it highlights documented cases where cyber attacks have successfully shut down power for hundreds of thousands of people.
It's terrifying when you realize how fragile it is.
I tend to think of this like the autonomic nervous system of the human body. The power grid is the heart, and the water treatment facilities are the kidneys. If the heart skips a beat, the kidneys don't just keep functioning on their own. They fail almost instantly.
That is a great way to look at it.
It's like plugging a microwave, a space heater, and a hairdryer all into the same old outlet in an old house. Eventually, the breaker flips.
Huh.
So what does this all mean for the listener when our systems literally have no redundancy left?
Well, it captures the true threat, which is cascading failure. We often conceptualize a grid failure as just the lights going out in a neighborhood. You light some candles and wait for the utility truck.
Right, an inconvenience.
But when you strip away the redundancy for the sake of efficiency, an isolated failure metastasizes. Electricity underpins finance, healthcare, telecommunications, and municipal water distribution.
Everything.
Exactly. You knock out a critical substation via a cyber attack or a physical overload, and you don't just lose lighting. ATMs stop working. Hospitals lose the ability to sterilize equipment. Water pumps fail, meaning fire departments have no water pressure to fight fires. An infrastructure glitch instantly becomes a national security event.
And when the physical grid proves itself to be that fragile, and the economic narratives clearly contradict the reality of people's bank accounts, The psychological load-bearing wall we discussed earlier simply gives way. You get a total collapse in public trust.
And we are observing that collapse in real time. The public's response to recent health messaging is a perfect case study for this. There has been mainstream coverage lately regarding the hantavirus, along with renewed institutional preparedness discussions around Ebola.
Now, historically, if central health authorities issued warnings about Ebola, the public reaction would be immediate, unified panic, and strict compliance.
Absolutely.
But the reaction right now is incredibly muted. People are effectively ignoring it.
It is deeply fragmented. The post-pandemic skepticism is so entrenched that populations no longer automatically default to trusting centralized health guidance.
They're just done listening.
Basically, they aren't just exhibiting health fatigue. They are fundamentally filtering official warnings through their own independent research and alternative information ecosystems. It is the full decentralization of trust.
And we are seeing this identical pattern in the political sphere, too.
Yeah.
The visibility of figures like Tulsi Gabbard is a prime indicator of this. She has obviously made headlines regarding her resignation as Trump's director of national intelligence.
Right.
And her public platform focuses aggressively on calling out Washington corruption, interventionist foreign policies, and massive domestic surveillance structures.
And the resonance of that specific platform, regardless of your personal politics, it just highlights a broader societal exhaustion.
Exactly.
Legacy media, traditional public health systems, entrenched political establishments, they are all hemorrhaging credibility simultaneously. The public is actively abandoning centralized narratives and migrating toward decentralized framework.
Whether that's alternative media or local food sourcing or independent financial structures.
Precisely.
Now, analysts often frame this as a, quote, credibility crisis, as if these institutions are just a brand having a bad PR cycle and they simply need a better marketing campaign to win back the public.
Good luck with that.
Right. I think that fundamentally misunderstands what is actually happening. The public isn't just shopping for a different politician or a different official doctor. They are choosing to inhabit an entirely different reality.
That's a profound shift.
The listener isn't just becoming aware that the Jenga tower is swaying. They are transitioning into a phase of active adaptation.
And that distinction is the key to understanding this entire convergence. Awareness is a passive state. You observe the problem, and often you just become paralyzed by the scale of it.
It's overwhelming.
But adaptation is a physical action. You change your behavior. You change how you allocate your resources, where you source your physical necessities, and critically, who you grant authority to in your life.
Which perfectly aligns with the conscious wrapping of this whole deep dive and the core philosophy of the Great Awakening Report. It is the conscious transition from living inside the matrix to operating at a higher frequency.
Exactly. Because when you encounter these headlines in isolation, 1,600 ships trapped in Hormuz, inflation contradictions, cyber attacks on water systems, sweeping political shifts, it registers as pure chaos.
It's designed to breed fear.
It really is. But when you map the mechanics and connect the dots like we just did, the fear dissolves. It simply reveals a massive, overly complex system under extreme pressure, mechanically adjusting to its own vulnerabilities. Clarity is the antidote to fear.
Clarity is the antidote to fear. Mm-hmm. I love that. Because once you understand the physics of why the Jenga tower is swaying, you stop being terrified of the wobble. You just calmly figure out where you are going to stand when the blocks finally shift.
Exactly.
There was a specific insight we always return to in these briefings. You're either outside acting in the movie or going within to watch it consciously.
The global infrastructure is going to continue its volatile adjustment. You cannot control the geopolitical choke points or the central bank narratives, but you have absolute control over your observer position.
You can choose how you react.
Right. You can remain violently reactive to every new pressure point, or you can step back, recognize the structural patterns, and maintain your personal sovereignty.
So as these massive interconnected systems continue to grind against each other, and as the traditional institutions continue to fracture in real time, we want to leave you with a question to mull over this week.
Something to think about.
What is your personal anchor? As the physical grid and the economic narratives around you fluctuate, are you allowing yourself to be pulled into the chaos and the daily outrage? Or are you actively using this knowledge to consciously build your own physical, mental, and spiritual resilience?
Identifying your anchor is truly the most important work you can do in a shifting landscape.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We will continue to track the signals, map the mechanics, and bring the vital threads to the surface for you. We'll see you in the next briefing. Stay grounded.